Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader. Welcome to the Lore of Us podcast, where the Lorehounds, your guides to a fungal apocalypse. I'm John.
And I'm David, and this is our coverage of the HBO original series, The Last of Us.
In this episode, David has some follow-up items from episode 1. Then I'll be doing a deep dive into the history of the video game. After that, we'll get into our in-depth scene-by-scene breakdown of season 1, episode 2, Infected.
Be sure to stick around to the end of the podcast for programming notes about other great podcasts coming from us and everyone else over on the Bald Move Network. One of our favorite things about podcasting is getting your feedback. We love to hear fan theories, pickups on details we might have missed, and hear what folks think about the episode and the season overall. You can send us feedback in 2 ways. You can email us at TLOU@thelorehounds.com or leave us a voicemail, which we can play on the next episode. Go to our website, thelorehounds.com/contact, and there's a little button there, and you can click and leave us a voicemail, and then we'll get to those on the next episode.
If you want to keep talking The Last of Us with us, join us over at the Bald Move Discord. Link is in the show notes and at baldmove.com. We have a well-moderated server and dedicated thread set up for The Last of Us. Each episode is siloed, so you can join the conversations at any time without worrying about spoilers.
We also wanted to make a quick reminder about our Patreon. We've got one. And if you like what we're doing and you think you might want to support us directly, check us out at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Some of our listeners don't mind ad-supported podcasts. Other people love to get the ad-free stuff. And other people just love to share their appreciation. So for as little as $3 a month, you get the ad-free podcasts and you get early access. So as soon as we get them out the door, you get them. Check us out.
Wow, what a value. Of course, you can always get our ad-supported podcasts on our Lorehounds feed by searching for us on your podcast application of choice or using the subscription tool at thelorehounds.com. Lastly, we'd like to ask that if you're enjoying this podcast, please take a moment and rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts. If you can leave a short review letting others know that what you enjoy about our coverage, that really helps us compete with the wide variety of people covering the show. You know, we're a small little independent network here, and every single review helps us fight the Apple algorithm that is behind closed doors and get in front of more ears.
And there are a lot of ears. There's a lot of mouths on this podcast. That's a lot of microphones on this season of television, too. Everybody's into The Last of Us.
A lot of spore-filled mouths. A lot of tendril-filled mouths that we're going to kiss you with.
All right. Yeah. I mean, not that this episode wasn't gross enough in its own way. You just added that extra little spice to it.
Well, speaking of this episode, what are your overall impressions?
All right. So I thought I might first start just to let everybody know, before I give you my impressions, sort of what my strategy is going forward watching the show. John and I talked about this a little bit, and we talked about it before the season started. John's played the video games, and he's deep in the lore. I'm going to be completely avoiding all the extra information that's floating around out there on the internet, other than what John brings in. And or if I do a little research topic on something like that. But I'm going to be avoiding the behind the scenes, you know, after credit little vignettes. I'm definitely not listening to the official podcast. I'm listening to a few other podcasts that might go into general scene-by-scene breakdowns, but I'm avoiding any of the spoiler stuff. I'm not going to be a monk. I'm not going to live monastically and hermetically seal myself in, but I'm going to just try to avoid everything and just try to appreciate the show on its own merits. Because I think, John, as we talked about, there's so much lore around the show, and it's kind of nice for one of us to be unspoiled in a way.
So, David, who did you get to do your carbonite sealing?
Carbonite are us. 1-800-CALL-CARBONITE. I don't know.
Excellent. Is that who Han used?
No, that was a whole other different thing. That was a state-sponsored carbonation situation, okay. I think.
That's fair.
Yep. Anyway, this episode, I thought it was a really good episode. It wasn't great in that sense of like, oh my God, it's broken new ground and it was really amazing. I loved the cold open. I thought that was great. I'm so glad that The Last of Us is on HBO, because HBO is a kind of network that's going to go, oh, you want to film in Jakarta? Cool. Here's your plane tickets. Can't wait to see the dailies. Yeah. Right? Like, they went to Jakarta and filmed. I mean, they sent a B-unit, you know, crew over there or whatever. That's fine. But they sent filmmakers from this production to Jakarta to film this. And I loved that. I thought that was great. And it was a great world building and backstory. So kudos for that. Everything else about this episode really was very functional to me. It did its job. It set the stakes. We have a clear understanding of the danger now. The main plot is now in motion, right? Joel and Ellie are, you know, bonded, and there's this one, they don't fuck this up, Joel, as her name, Maureen, tells him. And so the main plot is in motion now. All of the exposition is still really clean and is delivered as I would expect a character, you know, that particular character to, talk in real terms about that. It's not that fake exposition dialogue. Something I noticed about this was there's no B plot on this episode. Uh-huh. Like, it's all just Ellie, Joel, and Tess, right? And so maybe, and I saw some people not complaining, but just going like, oh, you know, wasn't sure about this episode or whatever. So I don't wonder if that was part of it, because it was just all one main story and we didn't jump to any B plot or C plot even. It was...
Well, I hope that that's not going to be a fatal flaw, because...
I don't think so.
This was a video game originally.
Right.
And you follow them. Like, that's how a video game works, is you follow the protagonist.
Right.
So I don't know if they're going to add more. They might, but... You know, I can't see them fundamentally changing that much.
That's an interesting point then, too, because that's going to affect the way, because we're all used to, in most television shows, jumping around to other characters or other subplots. And so for this, that's going to be interesting, because if we just stay in a single POV, in the first episode, we stayed with Sarah the whole way, right?
Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Joel and Ellie, and so we had multiple things. I'll say this. It's not that they never interact with anybody.
Right.
It's just that the point of view has been Ellie and Joel in the game.
Right.
But, you know, they could change that. Like, there's other people involved. Maybe they'll focus on somebody else for an episode or for half an episode. That would be fine with me.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to have to see. That's going to be interesting, though. But I think it's something for those of us who aren't the video game players, just to put that in our minds, that this isn't maybe going to be the same as a regular television show because of this POV as a video game kind of thing. So just a thought. Yeah. I will say that this was the most video gamey of the two episodes we've seen so far. I really felt like, oh, we got to get through this level and we got to get through that obstacle.
Yeah.
We have a goal. You know, it was very linear in that regard. And, you know, here are these different obstacles and puzzles that you have to solve to sort of, you know, get to your point. But it was fine. I could deal with it.
Right.
I was not at all ready for Tess to leave us.
You see why I dodged your question last time?
Completely.
Episode.
Completely. It was...
I was like, he'll know soon enough.
Yeah, I was really enjoying Anna Torv, the actress who was playing Tess. I was just getting used to her and getting in like, oh, I really... This person's interesting. We're not good people, Joel and I. Like, whoa, right? Like...
Right.
So dropping stuff like that, I was like, you know, bring it. And then, and it was a little bit of a cliche exit, but it's fine. I was happy with it. But, you know, still, it was a bit of a tropey thing. And then I was doing some, I haven't been able to do a full rewatch of the episode, but what I did see so far, I got up through the clicker scene, the, you know, when they're in the museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I skipped around a little bit because there's some, you know, some stuff that on a rewatch you don't necessarily need, going up, creeping up the stairs and things like that. But what I noticed, two things that really jumped out at me. One is great snappy dialogue, really funny lines. Oh, I've got an extra hand. Congratulations, or whatever he says, like he congratulates her, right? Just really funny stuff like that. And I really like that punchy dialogue and them trading barbs. And then the other thing that I noticed was that they do a lot of playing around with who's in the shadows and who's in the light. So we have Ellie sitting in that little grassy thing in that building, right? And she's in the light. And then we cut over to Tess and Joel talking. They're in the shadows.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's just tons of that all throughout this episode. There's another one that I'll point out when I get to my follow-up stuff about episode one. It's just something to pay attention to. And it's just, for me, something that, okay, is this production doing that kind of stuff? Great, tick. That puts you into the next sort of level category of production scoring, right? Like, okay, you're paying attention to that stuff. That's important. You know, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you're playing with those kinds of things. That, as a fan, as a watcher, that makes me happy that you're paying attention to that level of detail.
Yeah, no, the visuals are some of the best parts of this. And I'll go into a little bit of the development of the visuals in the game section.
So did you have thoughts on the episode two?
Yeah, I kind of felt similarly to you. It was not great. It was not like the best thing I've ever seen, but it was really good. But let me tell you how hot I am on this show. I watched episode one four times.
Four times. This is like a redux of Andor. I was like that when Andor
started. Yeah, yeah. I was not. See, like, I loved Andor, but I'm just not a big rewatcher of things.
Okay.
I have a pretty good memory for what happened, except Tess, which we'll talk about.
yes, your one miss.
Yeah, yeah. But I have a pretty good memory usually of what happened. And then I just, you know, I just kind of enjoy things on the first watch, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
This one, I was just hot on it. Like, I watched it like three or four times.
Wow.
And then the second episode, I watched it, and then I went to my homepage, and then I started it again, and I rewatched it.
Wow.
I did back to back. It was just, I'm loving this show. It is a dream come true for me because I loved this game.
Oh, that's cool.
And I always thought that it was something that deserved to be told on screen because it was such a good story and such meaningful characters.
Right.
And I'm just so glad that it's here. And so I'll be the super fan. You can be the casual, the filthy casual, as they call them in video games.
The filthy casual play. Yes. That's cool. I mean, I knew you liked the show. I didn't realize it was at that level.
Yeah, no, I'm hot on it. So I'll keep bringing the fire.
That's great.
So you have some thoughts on episode one, don't you, that you want to touch on?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts on episode one, but then also stuff about, I made two references to other.
Okay, your old man movies.
Yes, yes.
The old man and the VHS tape.
Get off my lawn, kids. The Andromeda Strain, 1971 movie. I actually started rewatching it over the weekend. I didn't get, again, I don't always have a lot of free time to myself, but I've watched about just under half of it now. Great movie, really fun companion to be watching with this. But I had theorized that that was like possibly some space fungus? And I was wrong. So that was a crystalline microorganism structure. I don't want to spoil anything else, but it was not a fungus. But cool thing, it's the first Michael Crichton book that was turned into a movie. It was his sixth novel, and yeah, 1971. And for its time, it was really sort of groundbreaking in some of the technology they used and the storytelling devices that they used. So if you're into old man movies, I would highly recommend watching it while The Last of Us is on. It's a fun parallel story.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So my other recommendation was The Omega Man, which was also 1971, Charlton Heston. But I couldn't remember the book reference specifically, and it's based on a book called I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. And then it was also adapted into a film in 1964 called The Last Man on Earth. And then the Will Smith
I've actually
movie
seen that one.
2007. Really? Interesting.
I've seen The Last Man on Earth. My grandpa showed that to me.
Wow.
So I've seen the oldest movie on this list.
Okay. Wow.
And yet I haven't seen the other one. So okay. I guess maybe do I get a little bit of old man points here? I don't know.
No. Okay. You were a baby. Somebody forced you to watch it. You didn't watch it on
Fair enough. Television. Fair enough. Yeah, I think it was like 12. It was terrifying.
Right. but Richard Matheson was the, I wanted to make sure I got the author credited right. So.
Right. All right, great. So what do you have for me on your episode one rewatch?
Yeah, so I did a rewatch and I really enjoyed it even more afterwards. I wanted to talk briefly about Joel's watch. I think that from what I could tell, Joel's watch is a show. They made that watch for the show.
No, he had a broken watch in the.
No. That design, like that's not a real watch. Yeah, yeah. Like if you couldn't go to the watch shop and buy that watch. I think.
Gotcha.
If you know otherwise, dear listeners, please email us and let me know. But what I could tell was that it was kind of a replica watch that they made for the show, and apparently they sold some of them on the market.
Interesting.
But that watch is based on a quote unquote field watch, and that band is definitely like a NATO military band or whatever. And like you know, these military watches, it's not like they're restricted to the military. You can go buy them. But they make them for people in the military. So I have a feeling that Joel served in the military as well as Tommy. I bet they both served.
Yeah.
And so that was my clue for him, because why else would Sarah get that watch fixed for him? Why was it meaningful? Because maybe when he served, that was, you know, watch, and that's a part of his past.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So about the light and shadow stuff, the first thing we see of Ellie when we're introduced to her in the room, is her face in light, in bright light. So shadows around her, and she herself is lit up. And it just really calls to that whole thing, you know, in the darkness, look to the light, you know, that we see spray painted around. So, you know, right there, bang, they hit us with the fact that, you know, Ellie's important in some ways. Everybody else, you know, they're not necessarily fully in shadows, but they're not lit up like she is.
Right. She is the light in the darkness, really. I mean, she's the hope.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole thing of Ellie holding out her arm, you know, and keeping it steady, and then we go back to Sarah in class with the classmate with the twitchy arm. Mm-hmm. There was some question about, like, was that just, what was that? Well, that's an initial sign that you've been infected with the fungus, is right. That you lose those fine motor skills or gross motor skills or whatever. And so when they ask Ellie to hold out her arms and count to 10, that's part of the test, and if you can't do it if you've been infected. And so that classmate in Sarah's class was infected. That's why that person's arm was twitching.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When Joel goes back to his room in the QZ, there's a color wash in his room from the drapes in the room and the, you know, the light coming in. It is the same rose pinkish color that's in Sarah's room at the beginning when she wakes up. It is a perfect color match between the two. And I was just like, I love you guys for doing that stuff. I love productions when they're thinking three-dimensional chess like that. And it's like, so Joel walks in, he's alone, right? He's drinking, he's taking the pills or whatever. But, you know, there's this echo, there's this faint wash memory of, you know, his former life. And then the way that they tied that together for us with that subtle color wash in the room, really, really inspired. Really good.
Nice.
When Ellie's looking at the big music book, the code, the little piece of paper, if you look at the book behind there, up at the top, the song title at the top of the book is The Long and Winding Road by the Beatles. And I thought that was just a cute, somebody in production on the production team was like looking through the book and they're like, well, we're going to stick this note. Oh, okay, here, let's, you know, The Long and Winding Road. Oh, cool, perfect. And it's like, because those old books were like phone books, right? You look up at the top, and it gives you, there might be two or three entries in that page. And, you know, you look through the top to see where you are sort of alphabetically or time-wise or whatever the key indexing is. And so so somebody saw, oh, The Long and Winding Road. I just thought that was nice. And it kind of does double duty because it's a song about memory and regret and thinking back to other times. But it's also this, you know, where Joel and Ellie going to go on a long and winding road, right? They're
right,
going to go
exactly.
on a journey. So it kind of does double duty. It was cute. I liked it.
Yeah. No, that's fun.
Great scene when Ellie calls out that Joel's watch is broken and he doesn't say anything.
Right.
And it's like, oh man, like boom, right there. They're messing with us between, you know, the lone wolf and the cub, you know, situation here. And so I just thought it was a nice little touch. Something that I didn't get was when Ellie tells Joel that the radio came on and she heard some song about Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, was she pranking him to learn the code, or did the music really come on?
No, I don't think it came on.
Okay,
she was just breaking the code.
She was just pranking him. Okay, cool.
Right.
Which
right.
is funny.
I think he would have woken up.
Because the song, Wake Me Up, right? Like, he's asleep, haha. So
right.
It's pretty funny.
Also, what a silly song.
Yes, it is. Wake me up before you go-go. Okay, we're not a singing podcast here. What's the deal with the butterflies? Is that a mildly interesting situation?
That's like a firefly thing. I think they're supposed to be fireflies.
Okay. Because there's butterflies on the windows and when she's sleeping.
Oh, yeah, no, those are fireflies. That's the Firefly logo.
Okay, no, real butterflies.
Oh, real butterflies.
I've seen people talk on the Discord talking about butterflies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't remember anything from the game that was significant about butterflies.
Okay. Well, if you're out there and you know something about butterflies that aren't fireflies necessarily, write in, let us know. TLOU@thelorehounds.com.
Yeah, I thought you meant like the graffiti with the fireflies.
Oh, right. No, I got that's the fireflies. No, but there's a butterfly in the window in Joel's apartment. When Ellie wakes up, there's like some butterflies flying around her. And I saw some other people talking about it in our Discord. So I wasn't sure what the deal was with that. Now, the song Never Let Me Down Again, 1987 by Depeche Mode, which means fast fashion. Did you listen to the song?
I did not. I was too busy watching this show.
Oh, dude. Okay. All right.
I had four rewatches.
Okay.
Or three rewatches.
So you had plenty of time
to
hear
it. And I also played some of The Last of Us 2 this week.
Okay. Well, anyway, so what I was going to say about the song is that it's a really great song. I mean, the lyrics are very simple, and there's a lot of people it's one of those songs where the lyrics are so simple and straightforward that people bring a lot of their own interpretation and meaning to it. And so people use the song to represent different things. It's kind of a chameleon in that way. But at the base level of what that song is about is I'm taking a ride with my best friend. It's just literally you're in the car with your best friend. You might be, you know, high or have been drinking or something, but because you're with this person in this contained space, somebody that you love, somebody that you trust, somebody that trusts you and loves you, and you have this bond, you know, as friendships are very intense, the feelings of friendship and camaraderie at those younger ages is really intense. And so you're just feeling like the world can be whatever madness it is outside, but for a moment, you and your best friend are taking a ride, nothing else matters, you're high AF, and it's all good because you're with somebody who's taking care of you and you're taking care of them and you're together. And that's sort of what the base of the song is about. And then, like I said, other people bring meaning. So I think it was a really great choice, again, by the production to pick that song up.
Now, that sounds like a good interpretation. And I think that's a cool song to bring in there.
Yeah. And it's great. It's got a good beat and you can dance to it.
So let me give you my follow-up on last week.
Okay.
Is that I have to own up. I made a mistake in my outline.
Dear
Lord. I said that it was Tess with Joel in the original scene. It clearly is not upon a rewatch. It was actually my third watch I saw, because here's what happened to me. The first watch, I'm going in and I know Tess is coming because I played the game.
Right.
And I'm like, all right, middle-aged woman with Joel, Tess. And then I just internalized that, and then she had the injuries later, so I'm like, all right, cool, that was Tess. Then I did an outline later, so I was barely looking at the screen, I was like to it and outlining,
right.
And so I didn't catch that it wasn't her again. And then the third watch, which is after we recorded, I saw it wasn't Tess, and I messaged you immediately, and I said, I will field the emails.
We got none, which is sad.
Well, we got like three, I got pinged on Discord like 3 to 5 times,
okay.
Something like right. that. Here's my announcement. In apology, I will donate 1 billion internet points to the nearest quarantine zone.
That's very generous of you, John. You're a true philanthropist.
And if you want to cash that in for real cash, it's worth 10 cents.
Cheap bastard.
The currency doesn't mean anything in the world of The Last of Us anyway. Anyway, you want to talk about the game?
Yeah, that sounds really good. I'm super interested in the background. So lay it on me.
So I was looking around for info I could get on the game, and I found out that in some kind of edition of the game, they included a documentary that was about 90 minutes long called Grounded, The Making of The Last of Us.
Oh, cool.
The whole thing's on YouTube now, so you can just watch it if you want.
Nice.
It is spoiler heavy.
Okay.
You should not watch this if you have not played the game, at least until you finish the season.
So we'll rely on you to distill the salient points for us.
Right. So I've taken some meta stuff that is not spoilery.
Cool.
And I've boiled that down. So let's start. So the game development started in 2009, took them about 4 years to make it, and it was released in 2013 as a PlayStation 3 exclusive. David, I don't know how much you're familiar with the world of exclusives in video game, but it gets contentious. People are very mad that the things are on PlayStation and not Xbox and vice versa.
Yeah, I know that intra-console wars are a thing.
Yeah,
but
it's annoying.
Yeah.
It's annoying. But anyway, so this was a PlayStation 3 exclusive because it was made by Naughty Dog. That's the developer.
Right.
And they are owned by PlayStation. And they are known for the Jack and Daxter series and also the Uncharted series. The Uncharted series is cinematic like The Last of Us is. It's basically like Indiana Jones, but they can't use that IP.
Never heard of any of them.
Well, they're good games.
Okay, fair enough.
So they wanted to do a post-apocalyptic game about how people sort of respond to some kind of world-ending thing. And they almost made it a plague that killed the people instead of making monsters because they didn't want it, the monsters to be the focus of it. But then they were like, well, it's an action game. We need something to fight.
Right. You got to kill something, right? Or be chased by something. Yeah.
Right. So that's where they were like, all right, we need something to be the threat. Neil Druckmann ended up serving as creative director for the game. He also directed this episode of the show that we're talking about today. Oh. This was his TV directorial debut.
Oh, not a bad job for a first time out.
I know.
I mean,
right?
It's a solid episode. I absolutely cannot fault the pacing or the structure. Everything paid off. Everything that was introduced paid off. It was good. It was a good
episode. Yeah, but you said it felt like a video game. That's probably because a video game director directed
exactly.
This.
Exactly. That makes a lot of sense, right?
Yeah. For sure. So the concept of the cordyceps fungus, this came from the creators watching a BBC Planet Earth documentary that was narrated by David Attenborough.
My daughter's
favorite.
And it
favorite. Was about the... Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, we
it
watched
was about the cordyceps fungus and ants that we've talked about, you know, in the show.
Might have to go find
it. I'm going
to
put the link in the description. It's only like a few minutes long, this portion of the documentary, and it's on YouTube. Designing the infected. They went through a lot of iterations. But they found their look when a concept artist sort of took pictures of fungal infections on humans and other skin diseases and created a composite of it.
Cool.
And they had this idea of the fungus splitting the face down the middle.
Uh-huh.
And that's how they sort of got the idea of the clickers, which we saw in this episode. I don't think they named them in the episode, but that's what they're called in the game.
There's right.
Clickers. All the other infected basically were based on the clicker. So the clicker was the base model, and then they went more or less infected from there.
Okay.
The clicker sound was done by a voice actor named Misty Lee. That's an actual person making that sound. And she also did the sound in the TV show.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so that's like a real noise she's making with her throat or whatever it is.
That is really cool. That is really cool. I like that. I just assumed that it was, you know, some sound effects person, you know, mucking about with a MIDI controller or something.
No, that's a person's throat you're listening to.
That's
and then
very
I
cool.
saw the sound designers are there and they're joking around. They're like, yeah, I just moved my mouth and made some wet noises to put underneath it to make it like really gross.
Yeah.
And it worked. I mean, it sounded creepy and gross and whatnot.
I'm going to totally be listening closer in the future. I did notice in the show that they add a lot of clicky noises, background, building creaks and things like that. So, yeah, I thought that was clever.
I think that was to basically, like, poke fun at the game players.
Okay.
Like, oh, you know what's coming.
Oh, to you twitch, cause coming, you to but... twitch out. Like, oh my God.
Right.
It's really
the
just
clickers
a
are coming.
Yeah.
Because nice. The clickers are terrifying, right? Like, they are a terrifying type of infection.
Yeah, we got to talk about it when we get to the scenes. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So designing the environment is another thing. So they read a book called The World Without Us by Alan Weisman. And this book is about how much work needs to be done every day to keep nature from like taking over civilization, from taking over the cities.
Wow.
And the point of this design is that the overgrowth is meant to be sort of beautiful amongst the horror,
like sure.
the nature is reasserting itself.
Yeah.
And the theme they wanted to portray was that life goes on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like when in the show, you see that duck pond that's in yes. the middle of the hotel. That's awesome. Supposed to be like, oh, life goes on, you know, like nature is here still.
The frog on the piano and the flocks of, you know, whatever's flying around the sagging buildings and stuff. Totally. Very beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that that's one of the highlights of the design of this world is just like the overgrown cities that are kind of horrifying, but kind of beautiful.
Yep. Yep.
So they first cast Ellie as far as the main characters. They cast Ellie before Joel. Ashley Johnson is the name of the voice actor who played Ellie in the game. And once she was cast, they had her play Ellie in all the Joel auditions. A man named Troy Baker came in, and as soon as he auditioned, they were like, that's the couple. Like, that's the pair.
Nice.
Developing the character of Ellie was really collaborative, because this was a time in video games where there was a lot of very sexist tropes and portrayals of women in video games. So this was a time where basically, like, women were either, like, damsels in distress or over-sexualized heroes or things like that. And there had not been a lot of, like, regular girls and women
uh-huh.
in video games. And this was kind of the first one. Like, they wanted her to be a regular person. But she was originally written as a lot more passive. Like, there was a scene, apparently, in the video game where, like, Ellie is saved by Joel in a car. And she's, like, kind of passive while Joel's getting attacked. And Ashley Johnson walked up to Neil Druckmann and is like, if I were there, I would go hit the guy attacking him.
Uh-huh.
And so he's like, yeah, you know what? You can give Ellie more fight. And they basically like overhaul the character to be like active and with an
That's
attitude
cool.
and with fighting her.
Okay.
And so this was a really collaborative process.
Great. I'm glad to hear that there was some thinking about that and about trying to make it a more realistic portrayal of like actual human beings, how they might actually respond
right.
rather than just the simple tropes, right?
Right. Like, if the guy you're with is getting attacked, like, why are you just standing there? You're going to probably grab a plank and hit him with it.
Right. You see, yeah, in post-apocalyptic world, yeah, you got to be an active survivalist, not a passive.
Right.
Yeah.
Especially, like, she was born into this world. She has to.
Sure. That's a good point.
So the cutscenes, that's, you know, all the yeah. scenes mm-hmm. that are really, like, movie-like, cinematic,
yeah.
they were shot with motion capture.
Nice.
And so the actors actually acted out these scenes wearing motion capture suits.
Mm-hmm.
Suits. They look ridiculous. Like, they have these, like, dots on them. And
yeah, I know.
It
yeah.
looks absurd.
I know there.
Yeah.
Yep.
And they received direction during this. They also had camera operators involved who had, like, boundaries put in for the rooms that they're in the games. They could edit the camera angles in post because, you know, it's digital. But they really tried to keep it where the camera people were, and they left any imperfections like shaky cameras or bumps into the wall because they wanted it to look like a live action movie.
Very cool. I like that.
Yeah. And so the actors were encouraged to improvise on set too. So like a lot of the dialogue ended up being more natural because the actors were to add things, add gestures, things like that.
Some cutscene stuff is just really stiff and is not realistic.
This was earlier on in the motion capture thing too. Like, mm-hmm. like nowadays they'll capture your face. Like
right.
they will do everything. But back then, they couldn't even do the face, so it was all just gestures, and then they had to watch the video and see what these actors were doing with their faces and try to design that artificially. I just have one last point. The Last of Us was remastered for PlayStation 4 in 2014, so just like a year later. It was actually one of the last big games for the PlayStation 3. That's kind of been a thing with The Last of Us. It's always like been one of the last games in a generation of games,
uh-huh.
of gaming consoles, and it pushes that hardware to the limit.
Okay.
So it did that with the PlayStation 3, and then it was remade for PlayStation 5 in 2022. The Last of Us Part 2 was released in 2020 at the tail end of the PlayStation 4 generation, and so it pushed that hardware to the extreme.
And is Part 2 literally a Part 2, like you finished the game, this picks up some point after the game is...
Yeah, it's a sequel.
Okay.
It's a sequel.
Cool.
Yeah, they renamed The Last of Us, the original game, The Last of Us Part 1 when they did the remake. So,
okay, right.
Yeah, I don't know why they did the part thing, but it's just a direct sequel.
Got it. And so there's versions, but only a Part 1 and Part 2, and then a couple
yeah.
of versions. Okay, got it.
Well, the versions of Part 1 are basically just graphical updates. It's not,
yeah, right.
There's some gameplay updates too, but it's the same exact story,
core
voice
story.
Acting, plot, all that.
Okay, right on. Cool. Well, that sounds awesome. It sounds like they really... made a game that they cared about, and it's got a lot
yeah.
of creativity embedded in it, which makes for such perfect growing, you know, I'm trying to think of some sort of mycology reference here, but, you know, something good to grow out of, rich soil for the story to grow from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's one of my favorite games of all time. It's you know, beloved by fans for the last decade.
Yeah.
You know, people are still playing it 10 years later, and I'm just glad that it's here. I'm glad that the show's here.
Well, cool. That was awesome. Thanks for bringing us that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to do it. Again, feel free to watch this, The Grounded, if you are already spoiled for everything. Just don't watch it if you don't have spoilers, because it's just going to ruin the whole game for you. It'll ruin the whole show for you. So anyway, let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we will talk about the episode.
Search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
And we're back. Ready to get into our recap, David?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. In 2003 Jakarta, in our cold open, mycology professor Ibu Ratna has her lunch interrupted by the police, who take her to a medical facility. She views a sample of Ophiocordyceps, which she is told came from a human. Upon seeing the human host bite and tendrils, she panics and leaves to speak with an officer. She learns that this started at a local flour and grain factory, which she refers to as a perfect substrate, and that 14 of the employees are now missing after the biting. The officer asks for a vaccine or medicine, which she says does not exist. She tells the officer to bomb the city and asks to be with her family.
This is a crazy scene.
What a cool cold open.
Awesome. I am so glad. Because like when they opened up and I was like, wait, where is this? This doesn't feel like the QZ. This doesn't feel like a back lot that they set up. And I love how they didn't. I mean, it's literally cold. Like you have no idea what's going on and why it's going on. But if you'd been paying attention to episode one, right, they talked about Jakarta on the radio.
Right.
And that was a nice hook. And it feels like the whole flower thing is that theory, which has been floating around, seems to be like they're going in that direction.
Yeah. If you don't know the theory, it's basically that people think that the virus, the fungus spread through the flower. And that's why, you know, if you look at the clues, basically it's that Joel couldn't get his pancakes because they didn't have mix. He couldn't get his cake because he forgot it. He didn't want to eat the biscuits. He didn't want to eat the, you know, Sarah didn't want to eat the cookies. So there's a lot of clues that
Atkins,
flour was part of this.
The Atkins thing is funny.
He's not really on Atkins though. That was, I see people citing that, but he was clearly like just not wanting to eat their gross biscuits.
Yeah, but it was a great pull though to throw into that mix on the whole, like how is the fungus like, oh, it's a funny line. So
right. If you were paleo at the time, you were fine.
I don't even think paleo was a thing back then. Like
it wasn't.
Atkins back then.
So let me define a couple terms here before
get
deeper into our discussion. So mycology is the study of fungi. You might have said that in your fungus
episode one. Yeah, I talked about
last mycology. Episode.
Yep.
A substrate, because I didn't know what this was, is the surface or material on or from which an organism lives, grows, or obtains its nourishment. So that seems like she's saying that the flower is something that is perfect for a fungus to grow on.
Okay. And it can be carried by it. And even if it's not taking nutrition from it, it can live within it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it seems like it can... Well, it can obtain its nourishment from it, so
right,
it
potentially
can
depends.
Be surviving on that.
Right, yeah.
So this scene was pretty dark. I mean, especially the bombing thing. If you listened to Bald Moves podcast last week, the instant take, I think Jim said, I would bomb all the cities. And then the minute this lady does it, Jim's like, well, that's a little too far, isn't it?
Pretty hilarious. Well, yeah, when she asks the officer, she's like, well, how many others? And he's like, 14. And she's just like, she's doing the math in her head. And she's like, nope, that's it. This is out of control. Like, if you had like one or two other people and you had them under control, fine. But 14 unaccounted for, like, do the exponential on that and, like, it's over. We're done.
Yeah. It's all done.
Boom.
It's all done. That's why she has to be with her family.
Yeah,
exactly. She just threw her hands up in the air. She's like, I can't cure this. We're done.
Yeah. And what does she just, she just says, boom. Like, just blow us up.
Yeah. I love that that was an English word.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They, like, everything else was in, I don't know what language, but then she just goes, bomb. And you're like, oh, man, she is serious. So what did you think about the squirming tendrils that she took?
Oh, that thing. Yeah, that was wild.
I was like, my wife and I both like squealed when that happened.
I thought it was great body horror stuff. And then also points to the fact that maybe the host is dead, but the fungus is still alive. The fungus among us is still there, right?
It's true.
Because it's a decomposer. You know, fungus can decompose and live on that stuff. So they can, it can just, and I think we've seen that, right? A lot of bodies that have been taken over and are dead and decayed. So that those little things popped out of the mouth, perfect horror jump scare type stuff. Awesome.
Right. It was spooky. It was spooky. I liked this. I liked the green factory thing. I think that they're really leaning into that.
Yeah.
And I kind of liked how ordinary everything was. I liked that the officer was really transparent with her, and yet there was still no cure. Like, she was just like, nope, we're fucked.
Yeah.
That's it. It was a good scene. It was a really good cold open, and that's definitely new from the game. It's not in the game.
Sure.
They don't do a lot of backstory in the game. They don't do a lot of, like, what happened immediately following the outbreak in the game, so I'm glad that they're kind of doing that now.
Yeah, and again, kudos to HBO and the filmmakers for actually going to Indonesia, getting Indonesian actors, having them speak Indonesian. Like, you know, I believe that that's Indonesian. I don't know for sure, but that they didn't pull in some Hollywood people and whatever. No, good job, guys. Really, thumbs up, double thumbs up.
That was really good. All right, so the next scene is that Ellie wakes up to Tess and Joel nervously pointing a gun at her. After trying to convince them of her immunity, she's finally allowed to go out of sight to use the bathroom. Joel and Tess are unconvinced and argue about whether to go through with the mission. Ellie tells them that she is supposed to go west because she is the key to the Firefly scientists finding a cure. Tess wins the argument, and the group heads into the open city.
What a beautiful way to start this episode. With her sort of on this mossy greenness and under the light, like, just great. And then, like, the clicking of the buildings and, you know, stuff. And you're like, uh-oh, where is she? What's going on? And then that whole thing, like you were talking about before, about nature reclaiming the city and right. Having all these scenes. So, yeah, beautiful. Really, really well done opening. I really enjoyed that.
There were a couple really good quotes in this. There was one that is Joel and I aren't good people.
Oh,
we're doing
man.
This for us.
That was such a great line.
It really tells you everything you need to know about them, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tess does not have a good image of herself or of Joel. She knows who she is. She knows that she's killed people. She's smuggled. She's just done what she needed to do to survive in this horrible world.
Well, and there's something to hear too about the whole adults and children and being able to, like, in some ways, we adults are, when we're trying to explain something to a child, we have to strip away all of the adult explanations and rationalizations and justifications that we've built up around ourselves and our stories about our stories, to be able to convince ourselves, like, oh, my job doesn't really suck. Or my boss isn't really like a terrible person or whatever. Like right. What, all the BS that we have to sludge through day in and day out to make it in this world. Sometimes when we're talking to kids and you got to strip all that away and figure out a way to communicate them to them in a way. So I love the fact that, yeah, Tess just does. She just comes out and just says, we're not good people, right? I'm gonna talk to you like an adult. We're not good people and we're doing this for a reason. And yeah, it was just really tells you a lot about Tess too, because that was the same way she was with Robert. Like, what do we have to do to get past this? How can we solve this? Let's not you know, let's not fill the air with words. Let's just get down to brass tacks and figure out what it is that we need to do here to move on. So,
If I could describe Tess's worldview in one sentence, it's cut the bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely.
She is just like going to tell you exactly how it is. But it's really cool because I don't think that there's a lot of stories where, like there's a lot of stories where you focus on somebody who's not a good person.
Yeah.
But it's very rare that you have a story where you follow a not great person who is very aware that they're not a great person.
Mm-hmm.
That is just okay with it. That is just okay with barely surviving. And that's Joel and Tess. I mean, that's them. It's crazy.
Right. And this whole sort of lone wolf and cub thing that they're doing. And, you know, what is the wolf willing to do to protect the cub? And how violent? I mean, we've seen Joel get violent already, right? In when he beats the Fedra officer to death with his hands.
Right.
And, you know, what we often talk about love making you vulnerable and what you'll do, but like, what does this situation do to somebody who's not a good person?
Right.
That's a cool question, right? And that's a cool premise to make a show around.
Is there a person in this world who has not had to compromise their moral compass to, mm-hmm. to survive?
Right.
I don't think so. Right. I think pretty much everybody has resorted to base survival instincts here.
Mm-hmm.
Another line I liked was, I'll just have to throw my fucking sandwich at them.
It's snarky. Because
you can't get a gun. That was the moment where Bella Ramsey won me over as Ellie.
Oh, really?
I'll tell you that.
Okay.
That was the moment, because that's a new line for the show. It made me laugh out loud. And it was just so bratty. Like, it was just so bratty. And that's exactly who Ellie is. Like, she does have a softness underneath. And I think we saw that last episode when she goes, but you've done this before, so we're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she'll have those moments, but she has such a callous exterior.
Yeah.
And that's Ellie. And I was like, all right, Bella Ramsey's got it.
And that sandwich looked delicious.
I know. So the chicken on the sandwich.
Yes.
That's kind of fun that, like, Joel and Tess are, like, mouth-watering because they can't get chicken and the Fireflies have it.
Right. They're eating some dried-ass beef jerky.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like,
with his broken hand, he can barely hold it.
We have to talk about the hand later because I thought that was going to come into play, but it didn't seem like it made a difference.
Yeah. Well, he said it was a mild fracture, so.
Yeah, but they were playing it up quite a lot. A lot. So much so that I thought it was going to be a thing that was going to cause some problem in the coming fight or escape or something like that.
Yeah, no, I think most of the point of it was just to remind you that he beat the crap out of that guy last episode.
Okay, I still think it's going to come into play. Maybe next episode.
Yeah, it might. It might. Also, Ellie's clicker imitation got me. That was good. And then Tess going, don't.
She goes, right, yeah, okay. And she stopped. She was like, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
And that really just goes to Ellie's precocious. I mean, it's a nice twist on the precocious child, the precocious youngling, right? Like,
I'm living in a world where you cannot be precocious. Like, right. You have to be so guarded all
the
time.
She was pissing me off, like playing around in the hotel and things like that. I'm like, no. You're going to get these people killed. Stop it. Yeah, she was pissing me off.
Well, in her head, she's like, well, I already got bit and I didn't die, so I guess I'm fine.
But she was like that even before she got bit, right? Like, I mean, she's been this way for a while.
Well, we don't know. We haven't seen her, but
probably. Yeah.
It seems like a personality.
Yeah, totally. So I got to talk about Joel, his skepticism with the whole thing. He starts finishing the sentences like, oh, yeah, miracle cure. Uh-huh, right.
Yes.
Vaccine.
Yes.
And he's like, we've heard all this before. And he even like said the lines that she was kind of saying. There was like this like layover between what, and I was like, oh, that was so great. And his skepticism and he called it. He said, this is not going to end well. And it didn't. He was absolutely right there. But yeah, interesting that there's some sort of narrative floating around about secret labs and cures and all this kind of stuff.
Well, I think the Fireflies are pretty open. I don't think they've made that clear in the show, but I think that the Fireflies are pretty open about wanting to find a cure. I mean, everybody wants a cure.
Of course, everybody
But
does,
I think
yeah.
that the Fireflies are like, okay, we have two goals. Reinstate the U.S. government, all branches, and find a cure because, you know, that will help with that effort.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think that Joel has heard the find the light thing his whole life. Well, you know, the last 20 years, and his brother has been sucked into it at certain points, and he's just sick of it. He's fed up.
Right.
All right, let's move on. In the city, they see a bomb crater, which Tess explains was used to slow the spread of the infection. They decide to take the safer long way to the safe house, to the state house, but first have to check the hotel. Ellie says she got bitten when she snuck into the mall in the QZ alone. So the scientist from the intro won, right? Her argument ended up being used worldwide.
Well, bombing, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yep.
The bombs were used in Boston, at least.
And what? And she says that they worked in Boston and not other places,
right? Which is a cool thing because they never explained like how the QZs popped up in the game, and I think that makes sense. Is like in some areas they were able to hold off this infection long enough to set up a perimeter.
Interesting.
And in some areas, no, the infected just got them.
Because that the wall around the quarantine zone is pretty substantial, watchtower, right. Big concrete wall, and stuff like that. So they certainly had to do some work to be able to get that established. Like, you don't build those in a day. I mean, concrete takes time to cure, et cetera, et cetera. You got to bring in a lot of trucks and material. Like, that's no small engineering feat.
Right. So, yeah, they had to bomb it just to get enough time to save some people.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So, we get to see more of the city here in this. Good exposition, right? Yeah, we find out more basics about stuff. So, yeah, good transition scene overall.
We also learn Ellie is an orphan here. I think they kind of said that in episode one, too, but they, you know, clarify it here.
Yep.
And Ellie is surprised at the lack of infected in the city.
Well, yeah.
They're there. They're just not in the open.
Not yet.
The group crosses an indoor duck pond, and Ellie says she can't swim. Joel emphasizes the shallowness of the water very sarcastically. Ellie plays in the hotel, but is startled by a skeleton.
I love the frog on the key. On the keys of the piano. That was really cool.
That was fun. I really liked Joel just like jumping in the shallow water, like, all right, well, walk.
Yeah. Great snark. You can really see their relationship developing there.
You can see how Ellie and Joel sort of mirror each other in personality, right? Like, they both undergone trauma and they both compensate for it in different ways. Like, Joel compensates for it by being cold and detached and very like the quiet man. And then Ellie compensates for it with humor and, like, you know, brattiness.
Right. Yep. But also remember, Joel and Sarah had a kind of tit for tat, you know, always joshing around, you know, playing, you know, snarking at each other. And like when she gives him his watch and he like listens to it and goes, no, are you sure you got it fixed? And like, you know, he gets her like that. So like, and you could see that that's developing between, that will start to develop between Ellie and Joel in this world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just that Joel's been closed off for so long.
Yeah.
Right.
And, he's had
to. It's hard for him to open back up. I think that every time he gets close to opening up, he is like, no, I don't want to get hurt again.
Yeah. A natural human reaction. Right. Completely understandable.
Right.
But yeah, like I was saying before, too, about Ellie's like mucking about, like, I was just like, don't. Please, just, you know, you're giving me a heart attack here. Stop it. I'm glad it was only a skeleton behind the desk there.
But I think she needed that, right? Like, she needed to know, like, anything could pop out at any time. You got to be careful.
That's a good point. Yeah. Because, yeah, she's only known life in the QZ.
Right. Up the stairs in the hotel, the normal route is blocked off. Tess climbs over and spends a few minutes getting the locked door open. Joel and Ellie have an awkward bonding session where Ellie learns that Joel is from Texas and Tess is from Detroit. We also learned that some infected last a month or two, but others live 20 years.
Yeah, again, good job on the exposition. Like, that's what this episode is doing, is like, you know, it's laying all kinds of information out for us. Pay attention to these things because they're going to be relevant in future episodes, I would guess.
Yeah. Put the gun down, Joel. That was really good, like, punchy dialogue showing Tess.
Oh, right,
Joel.
Yeah.
Tess knows Joel so well. That
right, exactly.
Knows, like, the minute he hears somebody on the other side of the door, he's going to pull his gun.
That
put
was
the gun
great.
Down, Joel.
And it wasn't like it's just me or something like that. It was just like, very, like you said before, Tess is no BS, right? She's going to tell you straight. And that was a perfect thing to do. Because when he hears that tone of voice and that kind of statement, he's going to instantly know that it's her. Because nobody else talks
yes, ma'am.
Her. Yeah. That was awesome. This was the one scene where I did feel like it was video gamey. It's like, okay, oh, here really? We are. Yeah, we're in, you know, it's like, what, I think it was when they started to cross the hotel lobby and, you know, oh, we got to go up to be able to see our route and da-da-da-da-da. And then when they got there and Tess had to go climb, I was like, yeah, this feels very, we've got to, this is a puzzle in the mission and we've got to complete this section to get to the next section.
Right, yeah. There's a lot of that in the game, too. The scene I thought was video gamey was hiding from the clickers. I think that's a lot of the gameplay in the game is
like, oh, sure,
stealthing, you know, using stealth to get around,
right,
you know, the infected. So, yeah, that felt like a video game to me. One more quote in this. Was it hard knowing they were people once? Sometimes.
Yeah.
That Joel kind of opened up for a second almost.
Right.
She got him to crack his door open.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Because, I mean, back to all the way going back to Mrs. Adler.
Yeah. Once through the door, the group sees a large number of infected writhing around in the street. Tess explains that there are more infected since the last time they were here. She also explains that the infected are connected via the underground fibers that can stretch over a mile. If you step on a patch of cordyceps in one place, you can wake infected somewhere else. The group decides to go through the museum. I just want to tell you, do you know what the showrunners called this in the post-credits explanations?
No, because I didn't watch it. So
they called it the Wood Wide Web.
Oh God, that's terrible.
I think it's kind of funny.
You do like your wordplay. You do like your wordplay. I will give you that.
I enjoy it. We have fun.
Something I noticed in this scene, again, good, all good information dump stuff. You know, a lot of density here of things that we got to learn. But something that I picked up on, it was that when the it was like a sunny, cloudy day out there. And as a sunspot moved across the horde, it caused the horde to react, which is when Ellie says, oh, they're connected. But there was something about the bright sunlight that upset the horde and the, you know, all the infected as it moved across. And you could kind of see it as a wave moving across. So I don't know if that's something in the gameplay. Or
it's
something
not.
They've added.
New, so.
Okay. So maybe that's something that they've added to. And it may not be like a daylight, nighttime thing. It may just be like strong light. Oh, it's like, oh, that like hurts our eyes a little bit. So we want to, you know, it sort of disturbs us slightly.
Right.
So, but we'll see. We'll definitely stick a pin in that one.
Yeah. You're not immune from being ripped apart.
Fuck no, you're not. Pardon my
good
language.
Line. She needed to hear that at that moment.
Yeah. Tess has given her a lot of practical advice throughout this episode, and I really hope in future episodes that there's a version of Tess that's living rent-free inside of Ellie's head, because she really right. needs Tess at the in the back of her brain telling her these things and keeping her impish impulses in check.
You know, Ellie got infected but didn't turn. Can she connect to fungal net? Can she connect to the wood wide web?
Oh, interesting. Hmm.
I don't know, because the Wood Wide Web wasn't a thing in the game.
Well, that would be very Picard Borg-like. did you ever see that? Is that an
no,
old man
no.
reference?
I have not watched The Next Generation. I watched some of the original series of Star Trek.
Okay, so Picard gets captured by the Borg, right? These evil, you know, hybrid robot aliens. And even after he's been de-Borgified, he can still sort of hear them in his brain, like he has a sort of a memory of them, and it helps him to be strategically one step ahead when it comes to interactions with the Borg. So,
Interesting. I just wanted to talk about the fibers in general,
yes.
this concept,
okay.
because this is not something in the game, but they did address this in the post show.
Uh-huh.
They said that they didn't want to do the spores because they thought it was not realistic.
Interesting.
If you do a live action show, because spores are everywhere all the time, which is true.
Yep. We talked about that last episode.
Right. So in the game, basically, the mechanic is there will be an enclosed space.
Uh-huh.
And there will be some kind of... You remember in the first show, we had the infected against the wall with all the fungus growing out of it?
Yep.
So you'll find one of those, and then the spores will be all in that enclosed place, and the characters have to wear masks.
Okay.
There's a lot of reasons you don't want to do that in a show. You don't want to have the characters covered in gas masks for 20 minutes. But also, their main point, apparently, was just, we don't think it was realistic to have spores. Because if it was airborne, it would have spread too much, I think they were thinking.
Uh-huh.
It didn't make sense to confine it to a space.
Tough visually as well, yeah.
Yeah. So they had researched fungus.
Yep.
As one does, as you do.
Well, yeah. I would hope that they would for the show.
Right. And they said, well, people say that fungi can be like the biggest organisms in the world.
Because exactly.
They can span like a whole forest. So we were like, what if they had this network underground of the fungus?
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they got to that point, basically.
Right. Makes total sense. And that's totally true. Yeah. The fungal nets, they connect trees and all kinds of other plants together. And yeah, it spreads for miles. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a fine change. I don't mind it.
I think I could see where the problem of spores would be too, just visually, you know, trying to show that.
It looks like dusty air in the game.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of stupid looking if you do it real life, probably.
Right. And then you've got a great tension knob there. You can turn up the tension by putting a whole bunch of tendrils out on the floor or on a stair, and you got to like step around them, right? So you can really ratchet up the stakes and the tension in a scene, which we have in the museum scene, right? Going up the stairs and stuff.
Well, why don't we take a quick break? And when we get back, we'll head into the museum. And we're back and ready to head into the next trap, basically.
The next section of the mission.
Once at the museum, Joel notices that the cordyceps in the ground is dry, so the infected inside might be dead. Inside there are bodies and fungus everywhere. One of the bodies is fresh, but they press on. Joel tells Ellie to be silent. As they climb the stairs, the building seems to be falling apart.
Yep, pretty straightforward, functional setup here.
Yeah, this was the most video gamey scene to me.
Sure.
And then the next scene where they're like hiding.
Absolutely. And when I was doing my rewatch, I just sort of skipped through a couple of these parts just to move along.
Yeah. I enjoyed the creaking stairs. That was a lot of fun.
Okay.
I enjoyed Ellie stepping on the hand and then being like,
right. Yep.
So yeah, it was enjoyable. It was a fun little journey in the video game. So when they reach the top floor, there's a large noise. After the noise, the group hears a screech and a clicking noise. Also, by the way, the screech is also Misty Lee. She does the whole clicker deal.
Okay.
An infected comes in making a clicking noise. Joel mouths to Ellie that the clicker can't see, but it can hear. What did you think of the clicker design, first of all?
Interesting. I was trying to understand what I was looking at first. On the second watch, I was into it more. I have questions about how they function naturally. Uh-huh. And then it made me think of, especially watching the fungus fight the clickers fight, that head stuff is gotta be hard and bony, and it's not squishy like a mushroom that you buy at the grocery store. This is a different kind of stuff. It's really wild. I think there were some people on our Discord who were saying they weren't sure about whether they bought into the design or not. But yeah, I thought it seemed like, I don't know, I felt like I was prepared for it, so it wasn't like a huge shock.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I want to know more about how they function. I think that's my big thing. Otherwise, I think they're great.
Somebody posted a picture, John the Maester on Discord posted a picture of, let's see what these mushrooms are called. They are the woods mushrooms.
Yes.
And they look so much like the clicker faces.
Yep.
It's definitely the inspiration behind it. So the idea with the clickers was the fungus has gotten so developed that it is coming out the middle of your face, like it's splitting your face in two. You can see their teeth have a gap in it too.
Uh-huh.
And then it basically is making like plates of armor, almost like plates of fungal armor for itself. Like the more you develop, the more the fungus will protect itself. And so the clickers are the infected that get to the point where the whole face is infected.
There's another kind of fungus called horseshoe or hoof fungus. And you see it sometimes on really old trees, especially where they're decaying, and it's hard, hard, woody material. Mm-hmm. You can't break it with your hands. You can't just rip it off the tree, and even if you do get it off the tree, you can't break it with your hands. It's so strong. So wow. I could imagine that That's what I was thinking of when I saw these, was that. And then, you know, when Joel shoots them, or when Tess puts an axe in the side of the head of one, right? These things aren't like breaking off. They're not soft. It's not like grocery store. Yeah, this is like serious.
And it takes
armor.
A couple headshots. Takes a couple headshots to kill them because they have like armor on their face.
Yeah.
I like that. I like the design. I think it's good. It looks very much like the clickers in the game. Like somebody said that it looked more symmetrical than in the game. I don't know. Fungi are kind of symmetrical sometimes.
Yeah. They have a pattern. Yep, for sure.
Yeah. So I'm fine with it. I thought they looked really spooky. I enjoyed that it was a practical effect.
Yes.
That was very much appreciated.
I'm looking at the picture of the one that Tess put an axe in the side of the head of. And the other one that Joel shot, they're different. Right. Not all of these are going to be the same. And I think that's cool from a artistic standpoint. Like they're going to be able to have some fun with these.
Right. So let's talk about how the clickers quote unquote see, right? So they don't have eyes. Their eyes have been consumed by the fungus.
Right.
So the idea is that they make this clicking noise and it's supposed to be like echolocation.
I was wondering.
Now, I don't think that it really works like echolocation because that would let them see you whether you make a sound or not.
Yeah.
But they kind of say echolocation and then they, you know, let that go out the other ear because really you need to make a noise for them to see you. But they're supposed to have this like really enhanced hearing. They're really good at hearing you.
Well, that I was questioning that. I didn't understand how that was working. I turned on the audio descriptor, right? So then I don't know if you've ever turned that on, but it's in the subtitle settings. You can get an audio track where there's a narrator describing the action and what the characters are doing. And then I also turned on the closed captioning after that and read the subtitles. And Joel, in the subtitles, they say what Joel says, which is they don't have eyes, but they can hear. And that's when he's sort of miming to Ellie, and he's not only sort of like, you know, pointing to his eyes and his ears and whatnot, he's also mouthing it, right?
Right.
So he's trying to explain to her.
I always watch with subtitles, to be honest with you.
I don't. I try not to on my first watch because I just get transfixed by the subtitles. And
I can't hear without subtitles. That's where I'm at.
Right. You're an old man now, too.
I know.
So I think it's interesting, but like, I still don't understand because like when he's reloading or when they're moving around, conceivably, if they have that good of hearing, can they hear your breathing? Can they hear your heartbeat? Can they hear the click of a gun, of a barrel, of the cylinder of the gun opening?
Right. I think they kind of did hear Joel. Like, that's why they ended up next to him.
Yeah, but when he's reloading, like, it goes around him. So, you know, like, I question how good their hearing is.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because, like, in the game mechanic, it's like, you have to push the stick only a little bit, so you move really slowly, and that's how you avoid being heard. But you can reload, and he'll reload fine. And so it's you know, maybe a little bit of video game logic here, but...
Interesting.
It's, I mean, Ellie's breath wakes them up. It's interesting. I don't know what the threshold is, but let's just not think about it too hard and say, they have really good hearing.
Okay,
and
fair enough.
If you too hard, they're going to attack you.
All right. We'll go with that.
So when the clicker gets close to the group, Ellie quietly gasps, which causes the clicker to hear her and scream at her, attracting more clickers. The group has to hide and fight them until the last one is dead. Tess says she has a twisted ankle and Ellie is bitten in the same spot. So this is where I was like, oh, she got bitten just now.
Right, yeah.
As soon as she was off screen for a while,
right.
I was like, yeah, that's it. That's the moment.
Right. Yeah, it was... This episode was predictable in kind of a lot of ways, and it was fine, right? Because if you're going to do kind of this simple, straightforward thing, like then do it well and deliver on the expectation. So,
right, yeah, and I'll defend Tess's death later. I think it's a good narrative choice,
sure,
not because of the trope, but because of what it does to the character's motivations. But yeah, I mean, I just knew she was infected here, and. Then I'm looking for, because I know what's going to happen, I'm looking for how this actor portrays this, like, desperation. That's
right. Right.
To do something.
Right.
To be a good person in her last moments.
Yeah, I definitely want to. Yeah, that's a good point. We should talk about that when we get to that scene. Another thing that I thought of when they were fighting the clickers and when Tess takes her first shot at one of them and misses. You can clearly see this spark of her round well off to the side. And then Joel has trouble hitting the first one with his AR. And then later on, he's got to take a moment to aim and, you know, hits it in the throat or something like that, right? It's not straightforward.
Yeah.
There was a scene, I don't remember what season or episode, but it's a pretty iconic scene when they're at Herschel's farm and they're escaping. Spoilers for a 10-plus-year-old show? I don't know. And it's the whole thing when, is it Maggie's daughter and like all the zombies break out of the barn and they have to flee and they're driving around in trucks and running around trying to get everybody together to get away from the farm. And they're headshotting these zombies like, you know.
I'm so glad I never watched The Walking Dead.
You never watched? Okay, so you never saw that. Okay, so they're just like dropping these things, headshot every single time. And I really like that in this episode, we see when you're jacked on adrenaline and the stress and it's dark and how easy it is to miss and how hard it is to actually get a headshot on something.
Yeah, and definitely.
You know, there's all kinds of studies and training and all this kind of stuff that show, like, you know, you get your heart rate elevated up to a certain point and your fine motor skills go out the window, and then later your gross motor skills go out the window. And so it takes a lot of training and repetition and drills to be able to control that. And these people aren't professional. This isn't like SEAL Team 6 or something here, right? These are just some people trying to survive. So to be able to get a shot and a kill shot by hitting it in the head, and even when you do hit it in the head, it's not necessarily dead because of all this hard woody matter that's
right.
Protecting it.
Right.
So love all that. Love all those details. Really, I think it's bringing something fresh and new to the zombie genre, and I really appreciate it.
Something that the game is known for is that because you're in this post-apocalyptic world, you're supposed to feel the lack of resources that the characters feel.
Very good.
So they give you very little ammo in the game.
Mm-hmm.
You have to really check like every drawer to get enough ammo. Like it'll scale with the difficulty. So if you're on very easy, it'll give you a lot of ammo. But if you're on a normal setting, like it will really make you struggle to make every single shot count.
Something I was thinking of last night, and we didn't talk about this at the beginning of the podcast, but you know, we had our power outage yesterday because we had a big winter storm blow through here. And I was going into our pantry to get some emergency lights out and you know, a few other supplies. And I was just thinking about, oh, what if it was post-apocalyptic and somebody was coming through my house? Would they find this box that has matches, a wind-up radio, a whole bunch of batteries and candles and, you know, all this kind of stuff? Like, oh, I wonder if scavengers would, like, find my secret stashes of you know, material around my house or not.
So if you're wondering why we got this episode out a little later, David was in a post-apocalyptic world for a little while.
Yeah, we had over a foot of snow fall. And we were fine all day. And then 10 minutes before we go to record, boop, power goes out. We got power back, I think, 3 or 4 hours later. We had some friends in different parts of town who had, they were out up and down all day long, but they live more on the edge of town, so more in some of the rural areas. But yeah, we got a huge amount of snow last night.
Yeah, we got a little bit less. I'm a little further south than you.
Right.
But we did have a sizable amount. It was definitely a snow day for sure.
We got more coming.
Fun times. All right, let's move on. Outside, Joel tries to help Tess patch up her ankle, but she sends him with Ellie. Tess tells Joel, how about you just take the good news? Ellie and Joel admire the view, but Tess wants them to hurry to the state house.
Yeah, because she knows, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could see her, like, she's like, in her, like, head in her hands. And just like, she is just like, oh my God, I have very little time. How long does she have? Because I'll reread the sign from episode
one. We'll have to go to the sign. Where was she bitten? I'm trying to remember. On her shoulder.
See, I think it's debatable if it's the neck or the shoulder. Okay. That's the problem.
Mm.
So the neck, face, or head bite has 5 to 15 minutes for infection. Okay. I don't think it's that because she would have been done already.
Yeah, I think it was more shoulder.
Yeah, so the shoulder has 2 to 8 hours.
Okay.
I think that's where she was. That's where I'm landing. Or maybe somewhere in between. I'm sure it's not like you hit this point in the neck and it becomes a shoulder exactly. bite. You know what I mean? Like it's probably like in the middle. So maybe she has like 1 to 3 hours.
Well, people should write in and let us know what they think of their pet theories.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this was a sad scene. You could, I mean, like I don't know what you thought at this point, but I knew what was happening at this point and I was just feeling for Tess.
I was, you know, I suspected, right? Like it was definitely in the back of my mind because I knew from the way that they were marketing and the way that the show's been talked about, it's Joel and Ellie. So we know that Tess has to drop out at some point. And yeah, you just feel the drama of the moment that this was probably a good opportunity for them to do that. I did like how Tess was like, take the good news, right? Like she's starting to come to grips with her mortality. And that she's not going to be around to be a moderating influence on Joel anymore. So she's starting to try to prep him to change the way he's thinking and feeling about stuff. I don't know about you, but I would be probably more scared of crossing that bridge between buildings than I would be fighting the clickers in the museum. I was like,
not Ellie.
No, she just doot, 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 right across.
She's like, this is wood. Get over it. I love how sassy she is. Honestly, this was the episode that sold me on her because we didn't really get a lot of her in episode one.
Right.
But episode two, I was like, Bella Ramsey is a good Ellie. Nice. This was a good choice. I get why they cast her.
Very cool.
So at the state house, no one is around. There is a trail of blood leading from a truck into the state house. Inside, they find all the Fireflies dead, one infected. Tess desperately searches for a radio or a map of where they were going. Ellie only knows that they were going west.
Yeah, this was interesting. I was trying to figure out, too, why they are all dead, and Joel just sort of explains it. And I was like, huh, that sucks. Right?
Right. One was just bitten and didn't notice it or was trying to, like, in denial or something.
Right.
And everybody just fought. Everybody fought.
If you're going to live in this world and you get bit, you know, you just got to be prepared to take care of yourself in that regard and save everybody else, right? Like you got to make a hard choice for yourself because you're not going to do anybody any good. You know, if you keep that hidden, you're dooming everyone around you.
Absolutely. I mean, maybe they didn't even know though. I mean, like if it's a small, like you saw how small the bite was on the kid in the first episode, you saw Ellie not even realizing she was bitten until she looked.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
They had a lot of gear. The Fireflies seem to be well kitted out.
They are. They have a lot of smugglers, but apparently not Joel and Tess. You know, they're not bringing the chicken.
They're not the chicken smugglers.
No, they're not. I will tell you, this is a big change from the game, that the Fireflies got infected. That whole thing didn't happen in the game. What happened in the game was that Fedra caught up to them.
Okay.
And Fedra, they got into a firefight and Tess was like, go, I'll hold them off. And I like this better, actually.
Yeah.
I like this better. This is a little less clunky. So Tess reveals that she is staying because she's infected. Tess's bite already looks very infected. Ellie's bite just looks like a cut. Tess begs Joel to take Ellie to the Fireflies wherever they are. She tells him he can also bring her to Bill and Frank.
So, yeah, pin in Bill and Frank. Who is the other person that we talked about last week? Who's the leader of the Fireflies? I'm blanking her name right
Marlene.
Now. Marlene. Marlene tells Ellie, do you think so-and-so was a terrorist?
Yeah, Riley.
Riley.
That's the other name.
Okay, so Bill, Frank, Riley, got to remember these names. I need to remember these names for stuff. Yeah, tough scene for, I mean, you know, and they all know, right? Like, there's a ticking clock. She could start to turn any time.
I don't know if I directly noticed this, but do you think Tess was twitching by the end of her run?
I couldn't tell. So,
people were saying that she was twitching, but I didn't look closely enough on my last watch. So,
yeah, I'll check it on the next finish my second watch, so I'll keep an eye on that. But it felt like she was getting weak, or like it was like starting to, like she was fighting the fever inside of her, kind of.
Yeah, that was tough to watch. Our luck had to run out sooner or later. Direct line from the game. Good line, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You keep her alive and you set everything right. You see what Tess is doing here. She's like, man, make this worth it. Make everything we did worth it.
Right, right.
Really hard.
Because it's hard to not see the evidence now. Now, so you've got Ellie with her bite, and it's like, okay, how long, whatever. And then like, oh no, wait, like Tess is dying because she just got a bite like 5 minutes ago. And here's Ellie, right, who's been, how many weeks ago was she bit?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. So it's kind of undeniable that something's going on with her, that she does, right, need to get to a research lab so they can figure that out. Whether she's the miracle cure or not, doesn't matter. Like, there's something going on here that deserves scientific study.
Right. I don't know if it's this scene or the next scene, but Tess says something to Joel that I think we should address, which is, I never asked you to feel the way I feel.
Mm.
This is more definition of their relationship than we ever got in the game. I think, mm-hmm, that we see now that Joel is closed off to other people, right? Mm-hmm. Joel, right, has not let himself love Tess fully. I think they had a sexual relationship, and, sure, I think it was romantic on her side, and, sure, I don't think it was romantic on his side.
In as much as bringing you flowers and, you know, taking you out to, right, fine dining restaurants.
They were friendly. They, yeah, were friendly in his eyes. But dependent. I think she loved him.
Yeah, and I think he loved her in his own way and just was not able to say it, express it.
Right.
You know, make pancakes for her, whatever his love language is. But he felt the connection. I mean, he was leaning on her just as much, but just the take a moment and feel it kind of thing wasn't there, right, for him.
Yeah. I think that Joel has just, like, since Sarah died, he's just been unable to allow himself to let go.
Survive.
To be vulnerable, yeah, for people, right? Because he feels like if he lets himself love someone, he's going to lose them. And quite honestly, he's right. Look at what happens to Tess.
Yeah.
And this is just another nail in the coffin to Tess, to Joel's, you know, morality, to Joel's, mm-hmm, love of the world, to Joel's optimism. I think, right, that everything that you're seeing up to this point is just like, man, this guy is on the down and out, and he's just going to keep being on the down and out. And I think that that's important to track going forward, all the tragedies that befall Joel.
Right. Shout out to the Ringiverse. They did Joanna and Mallory did a podcast the other day. It came out the other day on, it was kind of like Ringiverse University. It was kind of cool. They did this whole deep dive into the trope of lone wolf and cub, and how it plays out in different stories, and the origin story and of Lone Wolf and Cub, which is a Japanese manga thing, I believe. And they talked about stuff like Logan and everything else. And it was really good. And I forget who it was. I think it might have been Joanna pointed out that one of the things that Joel is dealing with is shame, right? And, yeah, shame blocks us from being vulnerable. And vulnerability is what we need for connectivity, right? Like, if I want to be connected to another human being, which we need as human beings, I need to be vulnerable in some way. And I think this goes to what you, right, were saying about the relationship with Tess. He was never vulnerable with her. That's what was missing, right?
Yeah.
He loved her. They depended on each other. They were business partners. They were survival partners. But he could never be vulnerable with her because he's still burning from the shame of his failure as a parent to be able to protect his child, right? There's the pain of the loss, fine, but there's another thing going on there, which is the shame that, you know, his one thing that he was doing and trying to be was a good parent and taking care of his kid, and in the end, he wouldn't do it. Now, we're not saying that Joel is at fault here in this situation, right? But he's feeling the shame of what his own perceived failure was.
Right. He just couldn't save her in his eyes.
Right. And so that is the thing I think that is when we talk about his emotional brokenness or his emotional cocoon, it's the shame that's the lock on that shell, right? That's the thing that's keeping the doors closed and allowing him to be able to open up. And in this scene, and I'm really excited to go back and watch it again and to hear what Tess is telling him. And apologies again, the head of the Fireflies, Marlene. Marlene, thank you. Marlene, also, don't fuck this up, Joel. And Tess saying, like, you know, keep her alive and set everything right.
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 Joel, save who you can save.
These are powerful commandments that he's been given,
right,
by these, you know, people in his life who see him as a tough, dependable, guy who can get stuff done. But to be able to get this job done, he's going to have to be somebody he hasn't been in a long time. And that was the person that failed in that moment was Sarah. So yeah, this is a good story. This is a really good story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. So one of the infected wakes up. After Joel shoots it, its hand triggers the fungal net and calls all the infected. With a minute left, Tess douses the floor with gasoline and tells them to go. Ellie fights with Joel to stay. Look at how quickly Ellie latched on to a parent figure.
Yes, right? Kids want that connectivity with parents and adults. Absolutely.
Right.
And and Tess was treating her like an adult. She said, I'm going to speak to you like an adult. And she compliments her. Like, "You, how old are you? You got a pair of balls on you, sister." Right? Like, so she was earning Tess's respect. And that meant a lot for Ellie to have, because all this time, she's just been treated like cargo. Right?
Yeah. And, you know, we didn't really talk about this that much, but the showrunners actually in their post-show of episode one said that they deliberately wanted to juxtapose Sarah's reaction to Joel killing somebody for her.
Yes. Yeah.
And Ellie's reaction.
Yeah.
Because Ellie was like, oh, somebody cares about me. Somebody's willing to fight for me.
Yes.
Whereas Sarah was just horrified.
Right. Because her dad killed
the neighbor.
It's really
the difference between somebody. Yeah. And it's really just the difference between somebody who was born into the pandemic and who was born before it and knew a lighter life.
Yeah.
As the infected come in, Tess struggles to light her lighter. An infected brings his mouth to Tess's to let the fungal net connect to her. I think that's what they were doing. Tess lights the lighter and burns all the infected. Ellie and Joel look back at the building and move on with their journey. And that's that for the episode.
I don't know that it's the fungal net in that same way. I mean, it's trying to feed on her, and that's how it feeds, is by putting those mycelium out, penetrating, and then releasing the stuff that breaks down the nutrients into molecular form.
So I think that they were reacting to her differently than infected reacted to them before. So because I think that because she's infected.
Right, right. So that they can tell. Okay.
So I do think that something different is happening.
All right, I'll keep an eye on it.
Trying to infect her.
When I rewatch. And listeners, if you've got a theory on that, write in. Because I think that's a good question.
Any other thoughts on this episode?
It was just gross trying to watch the fungi's kiss. Like, I was like, Right?
I was like, ugh.
No. It was good. Good horror. Like, good job, guys. I don't want to see that anymore, but good job.
Yeah.
Cliche ending, right? You know, last minute lighter, you know, boom, you know, fine.
Yeah
it's fine. Too bad that I don't know if the truck got blown up or...
That would have been nice, right? If they had a nice truck to drive off with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you got a long way to go. I don't know how you're going to get to Wyoming on foot from Boston.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Why don't we do our housekeeping?
Sounds good.
Let's thank our Lore Master patrons first. Samartian, Mark H., Michael G., Cyrus, and... David W.
I can't believe that we have that many people paying the top tier. Thank you guys. That it means a lot to us. All of our patrons. I think I just got an email the other day that somebody just they just went from $3 to $5. So like, let alone that you subscribe to us and then up your your level. That's even more mind-boggling to me. But seriously, thank you, everyone, for being subscribers to us. It means a lot to John and I personally, but it also means something practical, which is that we can use that money to fund. I mean, you have no idea how expensive running a podcast is. There's software, there's hardware, there's subscription fees, there's time, and everything that all our Patreons and our patrons and everyone who listens to the ad-supported podcasts as well. It means a lot to us because it means that we can keep doing it. So thank you all.
Absolutely. I mean, we could not keep doing this if we didn't have listeners, both public and on the Patreon. Maybe the Patreon. I mean, we didn't have a Patreon for a long time.
Yeah.
So whether you are a patron or you are a public listener, thank you so much for supporting us. It really is a joy to talk about this stuff.
Yes. But
you know, it's hard to find time to do it. It's hard to tell our spouses that we're going to go talk about a video game show exactly. For 2 hours.
At dinner time,
and, no less. At dinner time, yeah. But this makes us justify it a little more, so thank you.
Okay, so these episodes are going to be, for Last of Us, are going to continue to drop every Wednesday. Again, for feedback, TLOU at thelorehounds.com. It's going to be in the show notes. It's also on our website, thelorehounds.com. Go use the nifty voicemail feature. Please write in if you've got theories, if you got fanfic ideas, whatever, send it to us. Don't worry about my like avoiding spoilers thing as well. Like write in your stuff because I think it'll be fun to talk about things in the show. I'm just not going to go out and try to find objective answers out on the internet. So every Wednesday for those, for these. Be sure to also check out Bold Move. Jim and Aaron are covering The Last of Us. They're doing a full show on this. Sunday nights, they are doing a live reaction. On Tuesdays, their main episodes are going to come out. And then on Thursdays, they're doing an all feedback episode. And you can find that on their Savage Starlight feed, which if you're not a video game player, Savage Starlight apparently was a comic book that you could collect in the game, is very cool.
It's a fun little collectible.
So wait, we've got one episode left of Kaleidoscope, right? Is that true?
Unfortunately,
the white episode.
You can take that however you want. Unfortunate that we're ending it. Unfortunate that we have to watch it.
Indeed.
Whatever you want.
Our season wrap, and that'll drop on this Saturday after this drops out. What else do we got? We have Silmarillion Stories, which is going to be out on Monday the 30th. What's the topic on there, John?
Of the beginning of days and of Aule and Yavanna.
Right. And then on Friday, February 3rd, we're going to do some Star Wars stuff. We're going to talk about the first five episodes of The Bad Batch. Season 2 is coming along really nicely. We're going to talk about our general Star Wars, some general stuff about Star Wars in our coverage. Two other cool things to mention, and we'll put links to these in one of them in the show notes, and then a future one in the show notes. We got to be guests on another Tolkien podcast. It's called Tolkien About. Well, that's what I'm Tolkien about, I think.
Yeah.
And we got to talk to the host there about two stories in Appendix A, the story about Aragorn and Arwen, and then about how the, what are they called? The Rohirrim. Hello. What are those people called? The horse people.
The Rohirrim, yeah.
The Rohirrim. Gosh.
You got it right.
My brain is at the end of a long podcast. that was a lot of fun. That podcast is out now. John will put a link in the show notes for that. Please check it out. Cool podcast. We had a lot of fun talking about it.
Have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
I listened to it today. She put the Law & Order SVU theme into her edit, and I think that's a lot of fun.
So right.
You want to hear why that's in there?
Yes.
In a Tolkien podcast, you got to listen.
The other cool thing we just recorded with Maester Anthony from Electric Boogaloo. He invited us on for his Clash of Kings read along. We got to do a chapter on Theon, the first one where Theon goes back to Pike to see his father. That episode is going to drop February 28th. So check that out on the Bald Move Hot D feed. Go to baldmove.com if you can't find that feed. But we had another great conversation with Maester Anthony and broke down that chapter, and it was a lot of fun. And hopefully we're going to have him on Silmarillion Stories before too long. So that's what I'm talking about podcast and Electric Boogaloo Clash of Kings out February 28th.
Well, that's exciting stuff.
We're busy podcasters.
I'm really excited to get... Yeah, we are busy podcasters. We keep saying we're going to slow down and then we never do. So come on this journey with us and listen to us talk about your favorite nerdy stuff. And we will see you on the next one. The Lorehounds podcast is produced by The Lorehounds and published by Bald Move. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. And connect with us on Twitter at @thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.